So last week we started with an introduction to the earliest corpus of spirituality in ancient India. And there are many ancient traditions, but the Rig Veda and the culture that was built up around it is by far the most ancient. We know that the Indo-Europeans originated more than 9,000 years ago. We don't know exactly when they arrived in India, but there was a migration from their original home in Anatolia eastwards until they came into the northwest of India, where their first outpost, you might say, were in the area of the Kulu and the Panchala, which formed a nexus from which their Vedic culture could spread outwards, and it spread southwards and it spread eastwards from there. We'll be looking at that more later, but let's tonight look more at what the Vedic religion aimed at achieving and at some of the hymns through which we can see what that inner attempt at union was. Because the Veda is fourfold, we should take note of all the elements. The Rig Veda, of course, is that which is composed of the Rigs, all the various words, the great mantras that are collected into hymns, form the Rig Veda. We say that there are around 1,028 Vedic hymns. The two gods most extolled in them are, of course, Agni, the god of the mystic fire, and Indra, the god of the divine mind, who wields the thunderbolt. But also, there is the Yajurveda, which tells how to set up the ritual of the sacrifice. There is the Samaveda, which says how to sing it, how to give voice to it. These were the three Vedas originally. Later, a fourth, the Atharvan, came in, carrying the name of a great sage and priest. These hymns are somewhat different from those that we find in the Rig Veda. They are interested in gaining power over dark forces and interested in healing sicknesses, subduing enemies, etc. But the Rig Veda is the one that we're going to spend most of our time on. The mantras that the Rig Veda is formed from tell us much. The mantra is a divine word reached by the one who sees. The one who attains the divine word is the Rishi. He's also called the Kavi, the poet-seer, who in deep communion, after much internal effort, hears and sees come into being the word. It is not a mere human word, it is the creative word. And as he hears this, the word fashions itself in his inner consciousness in certain rhythms. There are four great rhythms, meters, in which the hymns of the Rig Veda are recorded. Gayatri, of course, you've heard of. It has three padas, 3 feet, and each has 8 syllables in it. Then the Anushtub has 4 padas with 8 syllables in it. The two hymns that we're going to look at tonight are examples of this. Then, of course, there's the Trishtub and the Jagati, with four padas, 11 syllables, and then four padas with 12 syllables. Each of these have a certain impact on us when we hear them. The mantra, in fact, is divinely conceived in the seer's consciousness, takes birth, you might say, in the seer, the rishi. And so, as he encodes that vision in this powerful meter, that meter, as it is uttered, acts as a magnet that draws the thing that it's speaking about to the one who says it and to the one who hears it. The mantra, then, is powerful. It changes the consciousness. The rishi and the Vedic culture felt that it changed life. Not only does it change life, it ordinates life. The meters that are used in the Rig Veda are seen and felt as being the very rhythms with which the universe is created. So they have that kind of creative power. They are born from sight, they are born from audience, but they are born from divine sight and divine audience. And so as we discover and give voice to them here, what is occurring is that the divine is reaching its influence into our lives, into our worlds, and in a sense, fashioning a cosmos, in other words, an ordered world through the mantras. But the mantras don't stand alone. The mantras have, in a sense, to be put into a certain order. They have, in a sense, to ritualize and make felt to the physical consciousness that which they see, that which they hear. So the sacrifice, yajna, then becomes important, because if you just have the hymn, it is empty of the life and the flesh that the ritual gives it. The Vedic sacrifice is a physical enactment accompanied by the chanting of the mantras. What does the sacrifice affect? What are the elements of the sacrifice? The sacrifice is from here to there. It's from us to them. We are the people, and they are the divine ones, the shining ones, the devas, the gods, the goddesses. So what we intend to do is awaken ourselves in the enactment of the ritual so that we participate in the ascent of the sacrificed substance to that divine world, to that divine being. Who it is that conducts the sacrifice? Physically, it's the one who has arranged for the sacrifice. In the Vedic life, there was a lit fire in sacrifice in the morning and in the evening, at least twice a day, sometimes thrice a day, at all the ordinal points, around dawn, around noon, and around dusk. And the householder would offer milk and water into the fire. But there were also larger sacrifices, which were public, the Shrauta. And in that case, there would be an assembly of priests. There would be four different priests there to make sure that things were organized correctly, that they went in the right procedure, that the words were said beautifully, and that finally the sacrifice was conducted to its fulfilling close. The gods might be various. Agni is always mentioned first, and after him comes Indra. If you look at the order in the mandalas, the 10 mandalas of the Rig Veda, always you'll see Agni intoned first, and then Indra and the other gods follow, up until you get to the book that's dedicated to the Soma. This is the manner in which things go. Soma is, of course, the god of the divine wine, the elixir of immortality, the intoxicating principle of Ananda. So what we might offer would be something as simple as milk and water. It might also be grain. In some great kingdoms, there might actually be a horse sacrifice. But the sacrifice, whatever the substance offered, aims at establishing a communion between the human aspirant and the god who is watching. The gods, the devas, look upon the aspiring human as brother, and they want to help. And the way that they are able to help us is if we will take steps to establish this connection to them, and the sacrifice symbolizes that. So as we go through the sacrifice, you can imagine the impact that it might have, because you are physically taking steps. You are carrying the grita, the ghee. You are pouring it on the fire that is lit. And as this begins to register in your physical consciousness, something begins a tumult in your inner being, and you find yourself psychologically transported to these worlds. You feel the impact of Indra in your mind. You feel the impact of the Ashwans or the Maruts in your vitality. You feel the vastness of Varuna, the one who is oceanic in being, as he widens you and you become one with all around you. So the ritual of the sacrifice is essential as something that is done to grip our physical consciousness and concentrate it and carry it into the complete identification of the seeker with those who were sought. Now, the leader of the hymn is the Purohita. The Hotra is the one who lights the fire. The fire, Agni, is ourselves at our core. Agni is full of will, full of force for progress, gladness, brightness. He burns in every direction. Just so the human who's really alive aspires in every direction, is interested in all aspects of life, throws himself assiduously into every activity, gives himself utterly. And so, such a human is an ideal compatriot for the mystic fire. That fire burns not only in our hearts, but burns in all the world, where he's called Agni Vaishvanara. Burns above in the thunderbolt of Indra. He is the one that gives the light to Indra. He is the one who draws his light from Surya, the great solar reality of truth consciousness, of wideness, wherefrom all this originates. So there is a kind of cosmology inherent in the structure of the sacrifice, and we go upwards, world by world, to reach our station above, where we renew ourselves. Here, in our fleshly body, we are limited. We have only so many years given to us. But if we live in communion with divine consciousness and principles, then we become immortal here and now, let alone that we possess that immortality after this body is shed. So these are the deep goals of the Vedic seers: to encourage the one who sacrifices to really plunge into his being and find that core of aspiration and rise in consciousness, bringing the discovery of those divine powers into play in us. The divine powers, the devas, the gods, are seen as being born in us through the instrument of the sacrifice.
I'm sorry, I think I left the stove on.
So this might be a good time to play one of the hymns that I've got ready for you tonight. And it's the very first hymn of the Rig Veda, a hymn to Agni. And the Rishi in this case is Madhuchandas Vishwamitra, his son, Vishwamitra's son, is one who gives this. Madhuchandas means one who chants sweetly. By the way, I might mention that this is a hymn that Sri Aurobindo loved to translate over and over again. All the way through his life, from the time he first was introduced to the Vedas shortly after 1910 when he arrived in Pondicherry, all the way up into 1950, I think we still find scattered papers here and there where he translates and retranslates and refines how he renders the Sanskrit into English, just as an act by which he maintains his concord with Agni, the mystic fire. Let's see if we can pull this up. Maybe first, let's actually read this in English, and this way we'll go from the near to the far. Sri Aurobindo, in writing about education in India, by the way, said that the student should always move from the near to the far. So for us who are assembled in this room, English is the near, Sanskrit is the far. So we'll read this translation first. I magnify the Lord, the Divine, the priest, minister of the sacrifice, the offerer, supreme giver of treasure. Worthy is the Lord to be praised by living as by ancient seers. He makes present for us the gods. The Lord brings us riches, food and daily abundance, renown and hero's sons to gladden our hearts. Only that worship and sacrifice that you, Lord, guard on every side will reach the heavenly world of the gods. May the Lord, wise and true offerer, approach most marvelous in splendor, encircled with his crown of gods. Whatever gift you may choose to give, O Lord, to your worshiper, that gift, refulgent one, is true. To you, dispeller of the night, we come with daily prayer, offering to you our reverence. For you are Lord of sacrifice, enlightener, shepherd of the world, who wax mighty in your own abode. So like a father to his sons, be to us easy of entreaty. Stay with us, O Lord, for our joy. So you can see in this that he's the leader of the march. He brings treasure, riches, food, in other words, all the blessings that flow upon us, inner and outer, come from him. And if he did not carry our offering upwards, if our aspiration were not mated to him, then the sacrifice itself would be bereft of significance. What he gives us, what he pours into us, whether we think it's the right season or not, the Rishi recognizes, comes as the truth of the being in the moment. It's the right thing for here and now. Let's hear this in Sanskrit, if we can summon this up. This is the traditional chanting style in the Rig Veda. There are only three notes that are used. So it goes rather rapidly, I know, but you could probably, if you've looked at some of the Sanskrit that you know from your earlier studies of yoga, you probably heard some of those words come alive in this, the very first sukta hymn of the Rig Veda. It may be an acquired taste, but when you've heard this for some time, it's really quite beautiful. So the next hymn, which I think we can move to, now that we've been introduced to the fire, who is key, the leader of the sacrifice, is the Purusha Suktam. This is a hymn which cosmologizes the divine being. It speaks of this man. Purusha is a word that means man, by the way, in Sanskrit, who exceeds the universe. And yet installs himself into being within it, a portion, a mere portion of his nature is expressed in the world. But it is the self-sacrifice of this Purusha, of this man, that allows the world to come into being and is the first sacrifice. So as he gives himself to the world, it begins a movement whereby the world gives itself back to the divine. The divine becomes multiple, and the multiplicity tries to give itself back so as to feel that union with the origin again. So let's look at it first in English, and then we'll, if I can submit you to it, play about 6.5 minutes as it goes through the Sanskrit. By the way, you have the Sanskrit with you, printed on your sheet on the first page or two. And you can follow along and see what they're saying as you listen to it. But first in English. A thousand-headed, Sahasra, is the man with 1,000 eyes, 1,000 feet. 1,000 is a word that suggests to us the infinite. So the poet is telling us that there is no limit to this being. Encompassing the earth on all sides, he exceeds it by 10 fingers' breadth. Now, how do you get 10 fingers' breadth? You look at the world and then you do like this, you see. So you're seeing that, in a sense, the whole of the world that's visible to us is simply floating in the being of the Purusha. The man indeed, Purusha indeed, is this all? What has been and what is to be? The Lord of the immortal spheres, which he surpasses by consuming food. So he is, he was, time does not measure him. Time is something that occurs within his own being. Such is the measure of his might, and greater still than this is man. All beings are a fourth of him, 3/4 are the immortal in heaven. This will later have its reverberations in the Tantra. But even here, this idea in the earliest corpus of spiritual knowledge recognizes that there is a transcendence beyond the universe, of which the universe is a derivation, a limited expression. 3/4 of man, Purusha, ascended high. 1/4 took birth again down here. From this, he spread in all directions into animate and inanimate things. From him, the Shining One, Viraj, was born. You could also translate this as the vast, the bright vast. In other words, in a sense, where it says, from this Shining One, man again took birth. Now, this is interesting because maybe this Viraj, maybe this vastness, represents the womb of the Divine Mother, so that this one being passes through the womb to come into being again as the many, that she is that transition phase by which the one is delivered into multiplicity. That she is that which takes the infinite and measures it out into what will become measurable. As soon as born, he extends himself all over the earth, both behind and before, using the Purusha as their oblation, the gods performed the sacrifice. So he becomes the thing which is offered by the gods. So he has come, in a sense, through Viraj, this bright womb, into being where these others are waiting for him, in a sense, now to invest the universe with his substance. Spring served them for the clarified butter, summer for the fuel, autumn for the offering. Again, time is implicit now in the universe, which means that this universal offering does not happen once. It's not something that had a beginning and therefore has an end, but it's continuous. It's going on all the time. The universe is constantly being created. The Supreme is continuously undergoing sacrifice, is being sacrificed on this sacred fire by his functionary gods, who are only aspects of himself. They're here to form a function. They're not the Supreme. They're just the faces that we know. But this unknown, this Supreme Purusha, is continually creating the world from his own being through the gods who are his children. This evolved man, then firstborn, they besprinkled on the sacred grass. With him the gods performed the sacrifice, as did also the heavenly beings and seers. So you can see that the gods, the sages, the rishis, the kavis, everyone is part of the orchestra that's watching this universal symphony get conducted. From this sacrifice, fully accomplished, was gathered curd mixed with butter, the oblation. Thence came the creatures of the air, beasts of the forest, and those of the village. So, first, the heavens, the celestial realms, come into being. And now earth is getting formed. So you can see that there's a cosmogony here. The whole universe is being created from above to the below. So the roots of the universe, to borrow another image from the Rig Veda, are above, in Swar, in the divine realm, where the Supreme lives, and they stretch downwards, resulting finally in physical form, but originating in the transcendent spirit. From this sacrifice, fully accomplished, were born the hymns and the melodies. From this were born the various meters. From this were born the sacrificial formulas. And these, of course, govern the rhythms, the laws of the cosmos. From this were horses born, beings of power. All creatures such as have teeth in either jaw. From this were born the breeds of cattle. From this were born sheep and goats. When they divided up the Purusha, man, into how many parts did they divide him? What did his mouth become? What his arms? What are his legs called? What his feet? And here we have the only description of the fourfold order of Vedic society that exists in the Rig Veda. His mouth became the Brahman. His arms became the Kshatriya, the warrior prince. His legs, the common man who plies his trade, the Vaishya. The lowly serf, the Shudra, was born from his feet. The mouth, of course, who tastes the sacrifice, who gets to utter the sacred word. The Brahman who composed this poem, of course, put his people first. So the one who knows God, in a sense, through who, from whom the sacred mantra is delivered to humanity, is foremost, but the arms become the power that protects the people. The strength of the legs is in the Vaishya, who provides so much power to the life force that allows society to thrive. And the Shudra enacts in service all that must yet be done. The moon was born from his mind. The sun came into being from his eye. From his mouth came Indra and Agni, while from his breath the wind was born. So the moon is the principle of delight all the way to the back reaches of humanity. The sun represents the principle of the divine consciousness. So we have Ananda, we have consciousness. From his mouth came Indra. Indra is the god of the divine mind, not the supreme consciousness, but the mind at its divine level. And Agni, who is the universal fire, who knows all things born, and yet who is intimate in our hearts as the core of our own psyche. While from his breath, the wind was born. Wind, of course, Vayu, represents power, not simply the life force that we know, not just what we would call prana, but Vayu is a much greater principle in the Rig Veda than that. From his navel issued the air, Antariksha. From his head unfurled the sky, Dyauha. The earth from his feet, Prithvi. From his ear, the four directions. Thus have the worlds been organized. So you see, he's given a picture of the whole of the cosmos as it's come into being. And then he says, seven were the sticks of the enclosure. Thrice seven, the fuel sticks were made. So the seven sticks represent the seven worlds, the seven planes of being. So that would be this earth and the life force that animates it. It would be the mind. It would be the linking world of the divine consciousness, of the Surya Loka, where exists Satyam, Ritam, Brahat. Satyam is the truth of being. Ritam is the truth of being as it organizes itself into a perfect cosmological harmony. Brahat, that which is vast. And then above are the three worlds which later would correspond to the Vedantic Satchit Ananda. So these seven worlds were seen and known by the Vedic rishis, who incidentally are seven in number. Seven rishis, seven worlds, seven principles of being, seven sticks here where Agni draws things into the shape of this sacrifice. So there are seven sticks. Thrice seven the fuel sticks were made when the gods, performing the sacrifice, bound the Purusha as the victim. So, to make it simple, the whole universe is the altar upon which the Purusha is bound to complete this yajna. With the sacrifice, the gods sacrificed to the sacrifice. Those were the first established rites. These powers ascended up to heaven, where dwell the ancient gods and other beings. So this occurs in the 10th book, the 90th hymn of the Rig Veda, and is a compendium of the universe. It describes the Supreme, who agrees to enter in to the world by sacrificing himself. The gods conduct the sacrifice, and through using the Supreme's body, establish the regions of the cosmos, all seven of them, establish the orders of the gods, of the animals, of the plants, of the people, and of the people, all the four orders of society come from this Supreme Purusha. It isn't that any one of these orders is really supreme over the other. They all go into the composition of the whole. So just as this Purusha, in a sense, is recognizable in us individually, it's recognized as society as well. So there is a collective and an individual reflection of this Supreme. The four orders of society must work well for society to sustain itself. The sacrifice is how the society imparts reality to the world, ensures that the world continues, and in a sense allows the gods to live in the world through them who sacrifice. This is also true of ourselves. When we live in communion with the divine, say the Veda, says the Veda, then our life becomes real. The journey that we are making has a destination which we can reach. The sacrifice always goes up to get to its home. And so too do we journey through life to get to a home. The inner journey is more important than the outer journey. The sacrifice may seem to be a physical ritual that's conducted with a fire and a Vedian altar, but actually it's the inner concert of our being. It's the progress of our psychology where we grow into living active communion with all these various Godheads who take birth in us, leading us upwards until we are restored to that origin from which we came to, because we share Agni's original home above. That solar world is really ours too. And so when we have attained that, the journey is over. For the Vedic Rishi, all this is possible to the aspiring human. How far each one gets depends on how fully he's willing to give himself to this journey of the sacrifice. We can see that the Purusha gave himself utterly and yet remained transcendent. So too, if we give ourselves utterly, we discover the transcendence in us. That's the profoundest state of communion that the Vedic Rishi experienced for himself and offered to his fellow citizens in that ancient clime. So now that we've talked about it, let's hear that hymn of the Purusha.
Hariyo, dasyo ravani mane, adhyatnaya, adhyatnya vadaye, devi swastirastuna, swastiramanushekya, urdhvandigatu beshajam, sanno astat vipade, sanjatushpade, Om Shanti 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 Om Sahasra Shirsha Purushaha Sahasraksha Sahasra Pada Sahumim Vishvato Vritva Tatya Jishtatya Shambhulam Purusha Devedaka Saravam यद्भूतैश्च भव्यम् भूतामृतत्वस्येषानः यदन्नेनातिरोहति एतावानस्य महिमा अगोच्चायाग्रश्च पूरुषः पादोऽस्य विश्वाभूतानि त्रिपादस्यामृतम् दिवि त्रिपादूर्धौ दयित्पुरुषः पादोऽस्येहाभवात्पुनः ततो विश्वम् व्यक्रामद साशनानशने अपि तस्माद्विराटजायता विराजो अधिपुरुषः स जातो अत्यरिष्ठता पश्चाद्भूमिमथो पुरः यत्पुरुषेण हविषा देवा यज्ञमतन्वता प्रसन्तो अस्यासीदाज्यम् भीष्मयुधमशरद्धभिः सप्तास्यासन् परिधयः सप्तसमितः कृताः देवायद्यज्ञन्दन्वानाः अवध्नम् पुरुषम् पशुम् तैयज्ञम् बर्हिषि प्रोक्षन्नो पुरुषम् जातमघ्रतः तेन देवा अयजन्ता साध्यार्षयश्च ये तस्माद्यज्ञात् सर्वभूतः संहृतम् वृषधाख्यम् अशोकस्ताक्षश्चक्रे वायव्यान आरण्यान् ग्राम्याश्रये तस्माद्यज्ञात् सर्वभूतः वृषस्सामानिजग्निरे छन्दांसि यज्ञिरे तस्माद् यजुस्तस्मादजायत तस्मादश्वाजायन्ता ये केचो भयादतः गावो अयज्ञिरे तस्माद् तस्माज्जाता अजावयः यत्पुरुषं यदतु प्रतिधाव्यकल्पयन् मुखं किमस्य गौ बाहु बाहूरूपाधा उच्येते ब्राह्मणोऽस्य मुखमासीत् बाहूराजन्यः कृतः भूरो तदस्य यदवैषः पदकालशूद्रो अजायत चन्द्रमा मनसो जातः चक्षो सूर्यो अजायत मुखादिन्द्रश्चाग्निश्च प्राणाद् वायुरजायत नाभ्या आसीदन्तरिक्षम् शीर्षोद्यौ समवर्तत पदकाम् भूमिर्दिशश्रोत्राद् तथा लोकाकल्पयन् वेदाहमेतम् पुरुषम् महान्तम् आदित्यवर्णम् तमसस्तु पारे सर्वाणि रूपाणि विचित्य धीरः नामानि कृत्वाभिवदन्यदास्ते दाता पुरस्तात्यमुदा जहार शक्रः प्रविद्वान् प्रदिशश्चतस्रः तमेवम् विद्वानमृत इह भवति नान्यः पन्था अयनाय विद्यते यज्ञेन यज्ञमयजन्त देवाः तानि धर्माणि प्रथमान्यासन् देहनाकम् महिमानः सजन्ते यत्र पूर्वे साध्याः सन्ति देवाः अधः सम्भूतः पृथिव्यैरसाच्च विश्वकर्मणः समवर्तताधि तस्य त्वष्टाभितद्रूपमेति तत्पुरुषस्य विश्वमाजानमग्रे वेदाहमेतम् पुरुषम् महान्तम् आदित्यवर्णम् तमसः परस्ताद तमेवम् विद्वानमृत इह भवति नान्यः पन्था विद्यते जनाय प्रजापतिश्चरति गर्भे अन्तः अजायमानो बहुधा विजायते तस्य धीराः परिजानन्ति योनिम् मरीचीनाम् वनमिच्छन्ति वेदसः यो देवेभ्यादपति यो देवानाम् पुरोहितः पूर्वो यो देवेभ्यो जातः नमो ऋचाय ब्राह्मये ऋचम् ब्राह्मम् जनयन्तः देवा अग्रे तदब्रुवन् यस्त्वैवम् ब्राह्मणो विद्याद तस्य देवाः सन्वशे श्रीश्रते लक्ष्मीश्च पत्न्यो अहोरात्रे पार्श्वे नक्षत्राणि रूपम् अश्विनौ व्यात्तम् इष्टम् मनिषाणा अमुम् मनिषाणा सर्वम् मनिषाणा ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः।
So we've talked about the inner state of union, which the Vedic seer achieves through the sacrifice. We can see that this stands as the first fruit offered to us from the ancient religion of the Veda. Where this will lead as the culture spreads and deepens will carry us into the study of the Upanishads. But before we actually get to the study of the Upanishads, next week we want to look at the last of the Vedas, the Atharva Veda, and discuss that in connection with how it would lead us from there through the Aranyakas and the Brahmanas into the Upanishadic age, and what that meant and what that life was like in ancient India. So that's next week. We'll look forward to that, but are there any questions here and now tonight?